You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
One I can hardly express. My mixed emotions and my thoughtlessness. After all, I'm forever in your debt. And woman, I will try to express my inner feeling and thankfulness for showing me the meaning of success.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that was John Lennon and Woman to introduce today's show. March is Women's History Month in the United States, and last week we aired Max Dashew of the Suppressed Histories Archives, sharing stories of women through the ages. We also heard from Artivista Kehan Irani, who uses theater and the performing arts to break through the unconscious barriers that separate people. You can still listen to that show by visiting our website, www.raisingsandradio.org. For the first half of our show this week, we'll continue the theme of women in the world, and we'll follow it up with Dave Meserve of Arcata, one of two Northern California towns that seem poised to bar military recruiters from marketing to children 17 years and younger. There were hundreds of International Women's Day events going on around the world on March 8th, from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. They range from small, random, informal gatherings to large-scale, highly organized events. All celebrate women's advancement and highlight the need for continued vigilance and action in this area. 2011 will mark the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day, and every subsequent year since its founding has seen additional events being added to the overall number of events. For example, in the United Kingdom, there were 257 official events this year. The United States celebrated at 192 events, Australia at 162, Canada had 130, and India had 47 events. At least 62 other countries around the world celebrated at least one official International Women's Day event. This indicates that female empowerment is embraced more today than at any other time in world history. And in the global push for gender equality in everything from business to politics and education to health, it's Europe that has made the greatest strides to close the so-called gender gap. According to the Global Gender Gap Report, published by the nonprofit organization World Economic Forum, known for its annual economic summit in Davos, Switzerland, Nordic countries, that is Norway, Finland, and Sweden, provide the greatest equality for women in equal pay, labor force participation, literacy rates, enrollment in tertiary education, female representation in parliament, life expectancy, and sex ratios at birth. These countries and their Western European neighbors account for 16 of the top 30 countries with the greatest gender parity in the world. The system of ranking this equality is based on an overall score expressed in a percent representing how much of the gender gap the country has been able to close. A score of 100% would represent perfect equality. The majority of the data comes from various non-government organizations such as International Labor Organization, United Nations Development Program, and the World Health Organization. Now, Norway, ranking number one, scored 82%. Finland came in second place with an estimated 82%, while Sweden, ranking third, posted a score of 81.4%. According to the study, the United States ranked at 27, behind Lesotho, which ranked 16, Mozambique, which ranked 18, and Moldova, which ranked 20. The United States closed 72% of its gender gap. The lowest-ranking countries were Chad, 129, Saudi Arabia, 128, and Yemen at the bottom of the list at 130. Nevertheless, even in countries whose rank is low, such as Pakistan, which ranks 127th, programs and campaigns are raising awareness. For example, the White Ribbon Campaign, active in Pakistan, is the largest effort in the world of men and boys working to end violence against women. In over 55 other countries, this campaign, with the tagline "Men for Ending Violence Against Women," declares, "By wearing the white ribbon, I pledge never to commit, never to excuse, and never to remain silent about violence against women." Go to our website, www.raisingsandradio.org, to download a copy of the report. Now let's turn to a clip from Russia Today for the following piece on International Women's Day in Russia, which has a score of 73%.
March the 8th is Women's Day in Russia. Many men wake up early and go out to buy flowers while their beloved ladies are still sleeping. It's traditional for men to give flowers, not just to their wives, but also to their daughters, mothers, and grandmothers. March the 8th is an official national holiday. It's a day when women receive more compliments than even on their birthdays. Working women in Europe have marked this day since the early 20th century to highlight their solidarity in the fight for equal economical and political rights with men. The Soviet Union followed the example of other countries and also began to celebrate women's contribution to society. So International Women's Day started in the Soviet Union in 1917 in order to mobilize women for the building of socialism. This is significant because the data embrace the changing female role in society. One can still see images of the ideal Soviet woman on buildings in Moscow, built during the time of Joseph Stalin, and also on old postcards. International Women's Day became an all-nations celebration in the Soviet Union.
That was in Russia. Now, two countries notably absent from the Global Gender Gap Report are Iran and Haiti. Now let's move to Iran and hear from the BBC, where it's a very different International Women's Day.
In the run-up to a planned demonstration to mark the day, almost all the leaders of the country's women's movement have been arrested, and many are still in custody. Here's our correspondent in Tehran, Frances Harrison.
This is the only footage of a women's demonstration against Islamic laws. The protest was put down with extreme force. Anyone who tried to film was arrested and their tape confiscated, and many innocent people got caught up in the unrest.
This is where the signature campaign kicked off with a protest last year. I was here and I saw women activists sitting on the grass, peacefully singing feminist songs. And within minutes, women police came and beat them very badly. They used mace spray and tear gas as commuters were making their way home and arrested more than 70 people.
Among them, 22-year-old student Dalaram Ali, who's now being defended by Iran's most famous woman lawyer, Shirin Ebadi. Dalaram spent 3 days in solitary confinement in jail and is now on trial.
I am charged with acting against national security, disturbing public order, and doing propaganda against the system, and having connections to illegal opposition groups.
But Shirin Ebadi says it's the police who should be prosecuted. The law allows women to protest peacefully.
My client, Dalaram, was arrested for protesting against discriminatory laws against women. She was attacked by plainclothes police who broke her hand. We filed a complaint against the police. Unfortunately, although 10 months has passed, no representative of the police has replied to the complaint, in spite of being asked to attend many times.
33 women arrested this week for showing solidarity with others like Dalaram, who are on trial. We were prevented from filming their protest, but just before she was arrested, one woman told us the authorities wanted to prevent any protests on International Women's Day.
They want to control us, so it's very important for them to how they can control.
Farouk has not been able to see her 7-year-old son for many months. Her story illustrates how the laws in Iran are weighted against women. Even though her husband was abusive, the judge gave him custody. Farouk lost her child and gets no financial support from her ex-husband.
From the moment he came home, my husband used to start shouting until he left again. So many times it ended in a physical beating. When my child heard his father's voice swearing, he would usually come in front of me to support me and ask his dad, "Why are you bothering my mum? Don't do anything to my mum," he'd say. But he would beat the child and throw him aside.
Farouk was allowed to see Ali Reza 12 hours a week, but in a police station. It frightened the child so much, she gave up. Now her husband doesn't let them meet and even prevents them talking on the phone. Farouk is worried about the damage it's done to Ali Reza.
One time he came to see me after some months, and I asked him, "Do you feel bad that I separated from your father and you are far away from me?" He said, "No, I could see how much Daddy was bothering you." That's it.
Farouk says because she loves her son, she's prepared to wait till he's grown up and can decide for himself. Parisa is one of an army of women across Iran collecting signatures on a petition asking for the repeal of discriminatory laws like custody, which automatically goes to the father if a boy is 2 or a girl 7. The signature campaign has struck a chord with many Iranian women, fed up with being second-class citizens.
In any legal case, I'm considered only half a man, but as a woman, I could be the breadwinner for my family. Why, if I die, is my blood money only half of that of a man? Maybe I am more effective than a man, so why should my rights be half his?
I have seen people around me. My mother and father got separated and my mother had real problems. The right to divorce is really ridiculous. I've seen women go and say their spouse is a drug addict and the judge says, "Stay with him, at least he can support you." The judges do not consider the value and dignity of women. It's disgusting.
Some of the women who collect signatures have been arrested. The atmosphere is so tense that many were afraid to be filmed doing it. The authorities see them as a threat.
Officials don't want to listen to the women's movement because they think it's something that's come from the West. But if they talk to us, they would see we're the same women who supported them during the Iranian Revolution.
But women activists do not find themselves completely alone. Some Iranian men, especially the younger generation, are willing to listen and support their demand for more equality. But the risks are borne by women, some of whom are willing to brave the inside of an Iranian jail to make their point.
In the next couple of weeks, I hope to bring a couple of Iranian women on to the show and hear more about what is going on in Iran and get their perspective. Again, not ranked on the Global Gender Gap Report. Another country not mentioned in the report is Haiti. Perhaps this audio clip could help us understand why this isn't even getting on the charts.
This is Cité Soleil, City of the Sun. The United Nations says it's one of the world's most dangerous slums, especially if you're a woman. It gets worse at Haiti's carnival time. Then as many as 15 women are raped every day. Their attackers live among them, armed men who move in packs. Half of the rape victims are children and teenagers. Cité Soleil at night. The Haitian police never dare come here after dark. These are the UN forces. They're escorting us in to film. It's the worst time for the women and girls. There's no electricity, no lights, nowhere to run or to hide, and there are always groups of men on the street corners.
They raped me, all three of them. One after another. Yes, one after another.
17-year-old Gina is 4 months pregnant. A gang wearing masks dragged her into an empty house in City Soleil.
They made me suffer. They made me suffer. And the baby in my belly, I feel like my baby has been torn apart. My baby has been torn apart. Torn apart. Now I don't feel right. I'm lost. I don't see their faces. I didn't see their faces. None of their faces. They wore masks over their faces.
Gina didn't report the rape to the police. She was afraid her attackers would come after her. And members of the police force have themselves been convicted of rape. And then there's the shame of it all.
They held me down to rape me in the street. They raped me in the street when I was on my way home. It was a policeman together with a civilian. Now I am in hiding because they say they will find a way to kill me because they are now in prison.
In a country where the military have overthrown the government and used rape to subdue the population, where the police, or Shamira as they're known, also used rape to terrify, it became almost inevitable that the men from the slums would feel free to use the same power.
Miriam Merlet, I want to attribute the high rate of rape in the slums to the periods of political turmoil that we've had in Haiti over the years. After the coup, the soldiers used rape to punish the population. Then the Chimeras in Haiti used rape to control the population. Women have been raped every time there's been political turmoil. Now the street gangs in the slums use sexual violence as a powerful weapon of control.
16-year-old Mary Jane lives here. She's too scared to show her identity. But she's risking her life to speak out about the gang in her slum who first raped her when she was 12 years old.
The first time it was three of them. They were from the same gang. It was at night and there were three of them. It was December 24th. I was outside and these guys grabbed me. They held me down. The first guy held my arms behind my back and raped me in my anus. And then they kept holding me down so the second guy could rape me again. Afterwards, I was crying in the streets and I ran home. I called my mum and she took me to the hospital right away. I had to be sewn. That's how bad it was.
Haiti's justice system is so weak that only 12 rapes go to court every year. The police unit in charge of child protection has only 12 officers to protect 4 million children.
I was raped again when I was 14. I was on my way to buy water for my mum when a man from some gang grabbed me. He said he was going to rape me. As soon as he said that, I ran away down a corridor, but he caught me and he raped me. I had been making T-shirts with a pair of scissors. After he raped me, he still held me. He hit me. I still had the scissors in my hands. So I pushed the scissors into his stomach. He fell on the floor. My parents tried to help him, but he died. His gang then tried to kill me. They burned down our house. Me and my mom escaped, but I was arrested the next day. I spent 2 years in prison.
She went to prison, but her rapist didn't.
It's important to get those who are accused of serious crimes, to get them before a court and to get them sentenced so that the message starts spreading that impunity is no longer assured.
Martisson is another notoriously violent slum in Port-au-Prince. Here, gang warfare is common. On its outskirts is the city's only drop-in rape crisis centre. Jeanette is one of 7 unpaid volunteers. She helps with the scores of rape cases that come through this door every month.
When a gang rapes a child, the child could just be on their way to buy something. It could happen at any time. Gangs never attack at a particular time. They wait and attack at any time. It could be the day or the night. They attack children and put guns to their heads, and then take them somewhere and rape them.
Millions of pounds of aid has already been poured into Haiti. The EU alone is planning to spend another 257 million euros here. But what has gone wrong? How has that money been spent when it can't even bring light to Cité Soleil or any security to a woman like Mary Jane?
I should never have been sent to jail because I was a victim several times. The gang burned down my house and they beat me and they raped me. I don't feel like I'm living now, because if someone is not free, they will never feel good. When I go out, I have to keep watching all the time. I also want to live with my mother, but I am not allowed to, because the gang could find me and hurt me.
That was a piece of audio from a video clip on Haiti, and you can go to the website www.raisingsandradio to view that. It's from the UK Guardian.
Hardly express my mixed emotions and my thoughtlessness.
On November 4th, 2008, voters in Arcata and Eureka, California, approved ballot initiative ordinances that prohibit the military recruiting of any person under the age of 18. The program is called Stop Recruiting Kids. Their website, www.stoprecruitingkids.org, uses the Youth Protection Act and makes it an infraction for any military recruiter to initiate contact with minors within the city limits for the purpose of recruiting them into any branch of the United States military. The ordinance in no way prevents anyone from choosing to talk with a recruiter if he or she wants to do so. Dave Meserve lives and works in Arcata, California, and served as city council member from 2002 to 2006. In the following presentation, Dave Meserve describes how a small group of people placed the measure on the ballot in last November, and they won.
I am here to talk about our efforts to prohibit military recruiting of anyone under the age of 18 in Arcata and Eureka. But I did want to start out with just a couple themes, first off, that I think are really important to any sort of activism, and they're kind of what drives my activism, and I think a lot of other people's. And I think the first thing I want to say is that I believe that as human beings, we all share certain core values. And this includes those on the far right as well as us who are more towards the left. I think, respect and caring for others, the whole idea of doing unto others as you would have them do unto you, the idea of fair play. It's the idea of the cowboy way. There is a feeling that people share as human beings, whether they're Americans or any other country in the world, which is that we have a responsibility to do right by other people. It leads to the concepts of peace and justice. It leads from there to the idea of the rule of law. And as activists, we have to realize that we're not the only ones who share these values. We're just people who feel moved to act on these values and to try to repair things when damage is being done to these values. We devise strategies to make real the principles that we believe in. And of course, the folks who are in power, those with great wealth, don't want to give up the advantages that they enjoy. They don't want to give up the power. And if we challenge them, they will challenge our right to do so. And so there's this continuous tension that's going on as we're activists. I know you're all aware of that. The second thing is, aside from the values, and this was really important in our movement up in Arcata and Eureka, is that we have to be inclusive in the message that we convey. When we have actions and when we're reaching out and when we're trying to, either whether we're on the streets, whether we're doing legislative action, whether we're doing initiatives, the only way we succeeded with our initiative was that we reached out to people who were different from us. We reached out to people who were not on the left by any means, and we said, don't you think it's wrong to recruit kids? We don't care what else you think, you know, who you're voting for in this election that's coming up, but don't you think it's wrong to recruit kids? And so, you know, we refer back to the shared values I talked about before, and I think another thing that we share with those folks, whether they're on the right or the left, is a mistrust of government. Now, the mistrust of government that we have may be slightly different from the more libertarian mistrust of government, but it is something that we share. And we also share this feeling that, you know, why are the fat cats getting all the money? Why are the people who don't do a damn thing getting the bailout, and all of us who work for a living not getting anything? And that feeling, and that is something that can bring us together with people who are very different from us. As a building contractor, which is what I do for a living, I find that, you know, a lot of the truck drivers who deliver stuff listen to Rush Limbaugh all day. But they still, you know, when I started talking to them about stopping recruiting kids, they listened. And if you can get past, because Rush's whole tactic is fear. You know, if you can be afeared of terrorists, if you can be afeared of those brown people coming across the border from the South and taking away our way of life, then you can be driven to do things that are not right. But if you can somehow let them know that they don't need to be afraid, or that those are not the things to be afraid of, then you have a huge number of allies. And it's the only way we're actually going to change the world, is to bring people who are not us and to the left, but people who are us and over towards the right involved in these movements. So I really, you know, believe very strongly in needing to reach out to those folks. And the third thing is we've really got to learn to work together better. You know, the so-called circular firing squad is too often in effect. You know, there are people who don't want to work with the World Can't Wait, or people who don't want to work with the counter recruiters, or people who don't want to work with the Answer Coalition for one reason or another. And it gets down to an ego trip in a lot of times. It gets down to talking about minor differences in tactics. And we're all on the same side. And, you know, the only way I'll separate myself from anyone at a demonstration or some sort of action is I'm committed to nonviolence if we're on the streets. And I don't want people being violent under the cover of our nonviolence. But I think that aside from that, I think that we need to learn to work together better and to accept that we each have a different approach and a different way of going about things. And that we should be inclusive of that. Because too often I hear people complaining about other people on the left, you know, because they're do things a little bit differently. So, you know, I'll get off my high horse now and get down to some specifics. But I really think, you know, those three things, the shared values, the reaching out to people who aren't like us, and the really working together are essential to our success if we're going to really change things for the better. I come from Arcata. Arcata has a long tradition of being a progressive city. Unfortunately, it seems to be losing that by design now. The namby-pamby Democrats have taken over. They don't want to see anything on the city council agenda that has to do with anything outside the city limits of Arcata. I was on the city council for 4 years. While I was on there, we passed the Patriot Act ordinance, which was the first ordinance in the country that actually prohibited city employees from voluntarily enforcing unconstitutional portions of the Patriot Act. Nothing like that is going to happen in Arcata anymore. We also had we supported troops who refused to fight in illegal wars. We opposed the wars. We called for impeachment. And at the same time, damn it, we fixed the potholes, you know? And there's this feeling whenever you're in local politics, what happens is you get people saying, well, you're not doing your job because you're focusing on national affairs. And you know, I can chew gum and walk at the same time. And we can fix potholes without having to be focused on that entirely. And we'd have a hell of a lot more money to do it if we weren't squandering the money on wars. So the question came up when the idea came up of perhaps doing something to stop recruiting of kids. One thing was to, well, we could have it as a city ordinance, and we could have the city council pass it. And I didn't think that was the way to go, really. I think that the ballot initiative was the way to go, because with something that's bound to be as controversial as what we've got going, the strength that we have with this is that in Arcata it passed by 73% of the people, which is a whole lot stronger than having something passed by 3-2 in a five-person council. And it's also grassroots. It's from the bottom up. It's saying, look, what can we all agree on as citizens of this city? So, you know, the question is, in trying to develop what this ordinance was going to say, was how do we weaken the ability of the military to recruit? How is it that we feel the impact of the war? I mean, one way is, yeah, our pocketbooks, we pay our taxes, and we're in despair when we see half of our taxes going to the military. But at the same time, when it really hits us is when we see recruiters in our town recruiting our kids to send them off to wars, and these are wars that didn't need to be fought. I mean, I do believe that the military is necessary, but that the military should be a defensive military. And if it were a defensive military, they would have no trouble at all filling the ranks of it with volunteers. And we would all be much, much safer than we are now, and we wouldn't have them prowling around the schools trying to get kids into the military. Now, the usual way of opposing the militarization of youth has been counter-recruiting. And it's a venerable tradition. It will have to continue in any case. But our inspiration in Arcata and in Eureka, which followed, was why should we be counter-recruiting? That's assuming that we're allowing them in the schools originally to recruit. Why don't we just say no recruiting of kids? Because it's wrong to recruit kids. Kids can't vote. We know that their brains haven't fully developed until age of 21 or 22. We know that both from our own kids and perhaps from our memories of our own teen years. If you can remember them. And so, you know, the idea was here not to counter-recruit, but to just stop the recruiting of kids. And so what we did was we wrote the ordinance, which the actual meat of the ordinance says that no person who is employed by or an agent of the United States government shall, within the city limits of Arcata, in the execution of his or her job duties, recruit, initiate contact with for the purpose of recruiting, or promote the future enlistment of any person under the age of 18. That's it. And that's what we went to the people with. I mean, there's more to the ordinance in terms of backing it up and supporting it, but that is the basic statement of the law there. And there are a few things to look at in that statement. One of them is that in the execution of his or her job duties, no recruiter can do this. Obviously, one of the first things that came up to oppose what we were doing was, well, you're trampling on the First Amendment rights of recruiters. They have the right to recruit, And we said, well, no, they have the right, obviously, in their own families to talk to their nephew or their son or whoever and say, I think he should join up the military, or to talk to anyone and do that, but not when they're in the execution of their job duties, because at that point, they are the government. And the government does have certain free speech rights, which we may run up against, but they do not have First Amendment free speech rights. And so the government, so we are not in any way trampling on the First Amendment rights of anybody by saying that recruiters can't talk to kids. The other thing that we immediately ran up against was, well, what about No Child Left Behind? Because No Child Left Behind mandates that recruiters in schools shall be given the same access as secondary, post-secondary recruiters and employment recruiters. And we actually, in the ordinance, we did not mention the word school. So we're not talking about, the impression when we were, gathering signatures to get this on the ballot, a lot of people would say, oh, you mean the recruiters in schools. And at a certain point, I kind of started just nodding because it was a little too much to explain the whole thing. But actually, there's a, whether you know it or not or are aware of it, there's a huge amount of recruiting that goes on outside of schools. It goes on often with the lists that are compiled from the schools, but it goes on at neighborhood events, at community events, at sporting events. It goes on at arcades. It goes on right on the streets themselves. We had a recruiting Jeep driving around town with a couple of uniformed recruiters in it that would, pulled up next to a couple of young ladies who were in high school and said, "You know, what are you girls doing? What are you doing after high school?" You know, just as they're walking along the street. And this is what we're really prepared. Whatever happens with this ordinance in court, we think that we have a very good chance of stopping that sort of behavior in the long run. And that's nefarious, at the very least. So when we were gathering, the first step in, we wanted to do an initiative, a ballot initiative, and we started to do it in Arcata. And to tell you the truth, there weren't very many of us. You know, there were five or six people who really did most of this in Arcata. And we were in front of markets, we were on the streets at the farmers market, we went to events, and we gathered signatures. And one of the first things we noticed was that some people would obviously just, you know, "Where do I sign? I want to get this on the ballot." No problem. The really interesting people to me were the people who would say, "Well, I don't think you probably want to talk to me because I'm from a military family." I say, "Oh, really? You're from a military family? And so when did you serve?" "Well, you know, I served in the 80s, say, you know." And you'd say, "Oh, interesting. Do you think these times are a little bit different from the 80s? "Well, yeah, they're a little bit different, you know." And when did you join up? "How old were you?" "Well, I joined when I was 17. You know, and you know, how do you feel about that?" And then they would start to divide up. You would get a few people who had joined, were in the Navy for 4 years, 6 years, had a great experience and put themselves through college, or got put through college, you know, actually did get what is promoted by recruiters happening to them. But you got a lot, I mean, only 30% of the people who are in the military get any money for college out of it, or at least that's been the statistic up, you know, till some laws have been changed lately. I don't know if it's going to get any better. So you have a whole lot of people who did not have a terribly good experience. And you get people who say, "Well, yeah, you know, if I had to do over again, I wouldn't have done that. And boy, I sure don't want my kid joining up." And then we would, you know, they'd say, "Well, you know, but he should be able to join if he wants to." And we'd say, "Well, no. And, you know, this does not in any way prevent anyone who wants to from approaching a recruiter if they choose to do so. All this does is prevent the recruiter from initiating the contact with the person under 18. So we're not in any way preventing someone who is interested and has thought about it and wants to join the military. They can go ahead and join the military, or they can at least get all the information they want to about it. What we're trying to prevent is the initiation of contact of the, "Hey, kid, what are you doing after high school? Wouldn't you like to join the military? You'll get all of these advantages." So, you know, the thing is that a lot of the folks who started out saying, "I'm from a military family," or some of them were, you know, "My husband is serving in Iraq right now." We got people like that, and, you know, maybe half of them would end up signing our petition to put it on the ballot. People who were, you know, in favor of the war would be signing our ballot because they didn't, signing to put it on the ballot because they didn't think that it was proper to be approaching kids. So what we're trying to do is to isolate this very small corner of the whole activism to end the war and say, what's something we can all agree on? And the thing that we could agree on was that it's not proper, it's not a good idea for kids to be recruited. Of course, another thing that a lot of people would say is, well, they can't recruit kids, can they? And, you know, my answer to that would be, well, I think you're confusing recruitment and enlistment. You know, kids can't enlist until they're 18 or at 17 with a parent's signature. But recruiting we define as the action of encouraging, urging, enticing someone to join the military. And that they start quite early. Has anybody here read the U.S. Army recruiting manual? It's a piece of work, let me tell you. One quote is, "You," and this is addressed to the recruiters. This is a training manual for recruiters. "You should view recruiting as a long-term investment. You will find as a recruiter that developing trust and credibility with students, even seventh and eighth graders, will have a great impact on your future recruiting success." Seventh and eighth graders, they're encouraging them to go and talk to seventh and eighth graders and, you know, "Hey kid, you want to work out?" You know, I mean, there's a lot of this going on. They set up chin-up bars at wrestling meets. And as people come into the wrestling meet, they go, "Hey kid, you want to see how many chin-ups you can do? Here, sign your name here. You know, make sure you give us your phone number." They also advise the recruiters, you know, if the person you're talking to doesn't want to join, say, for instance, "Hey, Johnny, if you don't want to join, do you know of anybody who isn't sure what they're doing after high school and doesn't have too many options? Can you give us their name and number, please?" I mean, these are all laid out in the recruiter manual. The recruiter manual is written as a sales manual. It says, it calls our communities market areas, our schools market areas. It calls the students, it calls the kids prospects. And when they sign up, when they enlist, they call it closing the deal. This is the language that they use. And it even says in there, it says, your job is to sell the U.S. Army to kids. So this is what we're up against. And this is the sort of thing where when you can start to quote the recruiting manual in ways like that, you get a lot of people who go, "You're kidding. They really tell them that?" You know. And of course, these recruiters, another thing is we tried very much not to blame the recruiters. The recruiters are in the service. They have to do what they're told, pretty much. It's one of the most stressful jobs in the service. We know that, three recruiters killed themselves in a period of a month in Texas a while back. A lot of recruiters have written about how stressful it is. People who've served in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they come back and they have to recruit. And as long as they're recruiting and meeting their quotas, they can keep recruiting. But what happens if they don't meet their quotas? You know, back into active service. You know, these are some of the issues we brought up. And during the course of this, what happened is we were gathering signatures quite successfully in Arcata, and a small group sprung up in Eureka, which is a neighboring city. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the cities. Arcata has always been kind of the lefty haven, home of Humboldt State University. And Eureka is a fishing and logging town, basically a blue-collar town. And it's in flux now politically, but... these people, you know, this group said, "Well, we're going to do this in Eureka, too." And now, you know, according to the rules of signature gathering, since I didn't live in Eureka, I wasn't able to gather signatures in Eureka. And I said, "Well, good luck. Go for it," you know. But I had zero hope that they would actually succeed. I just didn't think it could be done. And was I ever wrong? Because we got our numbers in a very timely fashion in Arcata and had plenty of signatures. And then, you know, the deadline kind of seemed to have passed because there's a huge lead-up period. If you ever do an initiative, if people here are interested in doing one of these, look at the schedule. And you have to get your signatures in way ahead of the election because there's a whole process that goes on. Well, I thought they'd totally missed the boat. And then they came in and they had enough signatures, and the city clerk, who was kind of, well, she seems a little right-wing, but she went to bat for them. And she got it through. She got the signatures approved. She had 21 days to approve them. She approved them in two. And they got on the ballot in Eureka. And I was amazed. I thought, this is very cool. And so we were always pretty confident that we would win in Arcata because it's Arcata. Eureka, we just didn't know. And The election came around, and we got 73% in Arcata, and we got 57% in Eureka. And I am far more impressed by the 57% in Eureka than I am by the 73% in Arcata. Because here it is, a blue-collar town where you wouldn't, you know, expect it. Lots of American flags lining the streets of Eureka. Not that that's a bad thing, necessarily. But it gives you some indication of what it's like. And yet the people of Eureka agreed that they wanted to stop this. Okay, so we've now passed the ordinances. They took 30 days to go into effect. And of course we knew, you know, the naysayers all along had said, well, this obviously violates the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And we said, well, I don't think so, but let's just cross that bridge when we come to it. Well, it came pretty quickly. The ordinances went into effect on the 6th of December, and on the 14th or 15th, both cities got letters from the Department of Justice acting on a complaint by the Department of Defense saying that they were going to file suit to invalidate the ordinance. And the complaint basically says that we're in violation of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Now, we don't believe that we are in violation of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution because there is nothing in the Constitution, although, of course, the Constitution has in it that the Congress has the right to raise an army. We don't believe that by preventing initiating contact with minors to raise that army, that we are preventing them from raising an army. And we also don't think that, we also believe that under international law, which is also the supreme law of the land, equal to the Constitution, under the optional protocol on the rights of the child in armed conflict, which the United States has signed, which has been ratified by the Senate, it sets the age for recruiting internationally at 18. Now, a small complication there is that the United States signed on with an exception to allow them to recruit at 17. Now, whether that exception is going to be accepted or not, we don't know. This is, you know, this gets into some of the ins and the outs of the case, which is in litigation now, and I can't really discuss it in great detail. What happened is we got this complaint, and then I started calling lawyers because I knew that we were not going to be able to defend the measure if it cost the cities any money. This was during the start of, you know, obviously the economic downturn. Everybody was paying attention to it. Suddenly, the cities were realizing their budgets were going to be slashed. Nobody was going to like us very much if we were going to cost the cities money. And so we had to take this stance of we will not cost the cities money. We will find pro bono lawyers. And the first person who stepped forward was Dennis Cunningham from down here. Some of you may know from various cases, including the Judy Barry case, some of the Earth First cases, and he offered to help. The city of Eureka accepted his offer to help, but the new namby-pamby city of Arcata didn't want an activist lawyer. So we got very lucky. Well, we had found in the meanwhile Sharon Adams, who is the woman who wrote the original ordinance for Berkeley, the zoning ordinance, to get rid of the recruiters over there. And she offered to come on to the case as our lawyer, as the proponents. And as the proponents, we're trying to intervene in the case and make some of the arguments that the cities won't be making. But she also had contact with the law firm of Manami and Tamaki, which is over there on Union Square. Brad Yamauchi, who's a partner there, agreed to take the case on pro bono. And they have done a huge amount of work on it. He put two associates on it. They must have worked for 40 hours each doing research and writing up both an answer to the federal complaint and a counter complaint. And in the counter complaint, what they do is they are suing the U.S. government to allow us to enforce our ordinances and to obey the optional protocol and to stop recruiting at least anyone under the age of 17 immediately. So a very aggressive response, which is just what we needed. And currently we're in legal limbo. We're sitting there on April 21st. The case of the interveners will be heard, whether they're going to allow us to intervene as proponents of the measure. The cities are not opposing our intervention, so that's a good thing, but we don't know what the judge will do. And then we don't yet have a schedule for the actual case to be heard. At the Oakland Federal Courthouse is all I know for now. Our judge is Sandra Armstrong. She's known as being quite conservative. She was appointed by the elder Bush. But necessarily, you know, being conservative is not necessarily a bad thing for this case, if she's any sort of constitutional conservative, and if she listens to the arguments. You know, the arguments we're making are both under the optional protocol on the rights of the child and also under the Ninth and the Tenth Amendments to the Constitution. And if you're familiar with the Ninth Amendment, what it allows for is for rights that are not enumerated in the rest of the Bill of Rights. And the Tenth Amendment allows for any powers not delegated to the federal government to be delegated to the states or to the people. And so the Tenth Amendment is really what authorizes ballot initiatives. The Ninth Amendment is what gives us, we believe, the additional right of parents to protect their children, or at least of parents to have privacy for their children, because privacy is one of the recognized rights under the Ninth Amendment. So it's going to be a really interesting case. I mean, it's been a very interesting ride up to here, and it's going to get more interesting. We have no idea how we will fare in court. We don't have a jury trial. We have a single judge who's going to make the rulings on it. And at this point, the Berkeley Peace and Justice Commission was right in the process of sending a recommendation to the Berkeley City Council to immediately pass an identical ordinance, you know, except changing the name of the city to Berkeley. And I called them up and I said, no, hold off here. You know, I would love to see that happen. But I know as a former council member that no council, no matter how much it supports the ordinance, is going to vote for anything which is currently under litigation. And so what we, you know, what I'm recommending, and we very much want other cities across the country to start taking this up. We would love to see it on some ballots in 2010, and there's still time to do that. You know, it's going to be towards the end of this year. You know, if you start organizing September, October for a ballot initiative, you can get it on there in time for, you know, a year later. But that's what it takes. And so we're hoping that at least by September or October, though this case may not be over, that at least we'll have some indication of recommendations we could make to other cities or to people who want to do a similar ballot initiative. Maybe there's a little language that needs tweaking a little bit. Maybe there's something that needs changing slightly to make it so that it will survive challenge where we may or may not survive the challenge. But it's a learning experience, and after all, I mean, nothing ever changes in this world if we don't challenge the authority. We need to challenge the authority of the United States government when that authority is being misused. And I'm sorry that even though we did drive out Bush, we haven't solved the problems, as I'm sure everyone in this room knows. You know, some people were telling us, oh, you know, don't, you know, just delay the case until Obama's in, and then it won't be a problem. I'm sorry. You know, I wish that were so, but he wants to see a larger military. He's increasing the troops in Afghanistan. We're not seeing the end of an interventionist policy. We're not seeing the end of preventive wars. We're not seeing the end of, you know, wars of choice. I look at what we've done and what we're doing here as really just a baby step. It's like such a small thing, really, is all we're asking for. It's just leave the kids alone. Leave them out of it. You know, don't try to talk the Department of Defense does a survey every year they do it twice a year, actually. In the survey, they measure the propensity of kids, it's a youth survey, to join the military. And they define propensity by asking a question like, do you think that you might ever be in the military? Do you think the military may be a part of your future? The propensity of 16-year-olds, they don't measure below 16, but they do measure 16-year-olds. The propensity of 16-year-olds to join the military is approximately 25%. By the age of 19, that drops to about 15%. By the age of 21, it drops to about 10%. So there's a reason that they're targeting kids. And that reason is that they are, you know, they're wowed by it. Wow, they can play America's Army, and they can, you know, sit there behind a 50 caliber machine gun and go bam, 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 and decide whether or not to shoot a person. Is that an insurgent or is that a friendly? You know, is that a Hodge? You know, and they get this all drilled into their heads through these video games. But it's the kids of age 15, 16, who are really anxious to do something adventurous with their lives. And they start to think about a little more by age 17 and 18. So that's why they're after them at that age. Now, something we haven't even touched on here is not the propensity by age, but also the propensity by income, economic standards, and by ethnicity. And right now, although African Americans are fairly resistant to military overtures, young African American youth, Latino youth are just being sucked up like crazy. And this is a whole issue we didn't even tackle in Arcadia and Eureka because we have a very lily white community with very little diversity in it. But it is an issue that we should be addressing in other communities where there are, you know, sizable populations of other ethnicities. So as I say, the whole thing, the stopping recruiting kids, is just a little tiny baby step. And it's moving forward, and it's a little baby step to do what's right in a world that's gone crazy. And I just encourage all of us to say, if we can take these baby steps, then we're moving forward to a world where there will be more peace and there will be more justice.
Go to the website, www.stoprecruitingkids.org, to stay in touch with how this all pans out. And this could be the beginning of a whole new trend in the United States. Certainly, young people of 17 years old should not be harassed by military recruiters. And that's our show for today. As usual, views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week when we'll present another perspective on women during Women's History Month. And this time we will hear from Afghan women from Afghanistan. Let's go out with John Lennon expressing his appreciation of women.
Without each other, there ain't nothing, you know? It was a different viewpoint of what I'd felt about women, and I can't express it better than I said in the song. Mm. It's for Yoko, but it's to all women.
For the other half of the sky. One I can hardly express.